Welcome to the Naughty Child Podcast with me, Richard.
And me, Polly.
I'm the dad.
And I'm the daughter.
Getting called out in the middle of the night to go carve a cow, to do a cesarean.
It's the closest thing to farming you can do in the middle of Bristol.
And then mum put on YouTube and then now it's there for the world to see, so it's great.
England were very chirpy.
And I think I only cried like four times, but they just happened to get all four times on camera, okay?
Locked myself in a procedure room.
Whether it shows something about me or whether it just shows I'm a little bit stupid.
I love people and I love cricket.
Suddenly I'm out on a helicopter because I can go on a glacier.
It's been the longest year ever, hasn't it?
My dog is now called Jimmy Anderson.
So I learned the anthem because I really genuinely thought they would make us sing it.
This is just a note to say this is a bonus episode to our usual weekly podcast. This was all about Project Darwin. We did a proper deep dive. Now, last week we did do one on our podcast, but we collabed with Storylines Podcast and had a much more in-depth discussion answering some of the really difficult questions and the questions that are slightly unanswered around Project Darwin, particularly to do with current county players and what happens with Tier 2 and Tier 3. So enjoy our little chat, and our normal episode will be out this Friday.
Won the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy.
Well, haven't we witnessed some absolutely sensational Test cricket? Ash Gardner, take a bow.
Welcome to Storylines, the Women's Cricket Podcast, with me, Melissa Story, and some very special guests, because this is a special episode. I'm joined by, as always, my wonderful co-host, Nikki Chowdhury, podcaster and journalist Polly Starkey of the Naughty Child Podcast, and Sonia Twigg, journalist for The Independent and freelance broadcaster. And we're going to be speaking all about the recent Project Darwin announcements and doing a bit of a preview of the season, which has started today as we're recording on Saturday. I think probably two teams have already been bowled out as we speak, which is a great start. But Project Darwin, the big thing. So let's dig into that. First of all, hello everyone.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey.
Great. Well, that's some great enthusiasm to go forward. So for a bit of context, women's cricket has made plans for, I think the way Sonia put it in your great article for The Independent, its third revolution in 8 years. The ECB issued an invitation to tender at the end of January and established the process that 8 counties would be awarded professional Tier 1 women's teams, and their status would stand for the 2025 to 2028 seasons. 2 days ago, or 3 days ago maybe now, the ECB announced those 8 successful bidders, but included some significant deviations from their declared process, with extra funding for and the predetermined accession of 2 more Tier 1 sides in 2027. Those have been decided to be Yorkshire and Glamorgan, and another 2 in 2029. So who made the cut? Many people thought the end result would kind of be the 100 hosting sides, but in the end, the 8 sides are Lancashire, Durham, Warwickshire, Nottinghamshire, Surrey, Hampshire, Somerset and Essex. Those are the counties celebrating. So, Sonia, let's start with you. First of all, were there any selections which surprised you of those winning Tier 1 counties?
Not really. So Richard Gold said ahead of the start of the season, the men's domestic season, that it wouldn't just be the men's 100 teams that got these women's Tier 1 teams. So I think from that, we were already expecting a bit of deviation. And obviously Middlesex's financial troubles have been pretty well broadcast, and the Sunrisers play quite a lot of their stuff at Essex anyway. So I'm not sure what they really, I know they bid for a team, but I'm not sure they really had the financial capacity to put a lot of money into the women's team, because as I understand it, yes, they get funding from the ECB for these women's teams, but to do a really good job, the counties will need to also provide additional funding.
There was that battle for the northeast as well between Yorkshire and Durham. Durham allegedly put in a really strong bid, but the response from Yorkshire has said that they were surprised and disappointed. Were you surprised as well?
Not really. I think Durham went really hard on their bid. I mean, they got sort of Ben Stokes and Paul Collingwood to back it. And I know Marcus North up there has done a lot of work to try and develop that as a regent for women's cricket, because they felt that they were really overlooked by the 100. And that if you're a Durham cricket fan and your nearest ground is like 2 hours away in Leeds, it's quite a long way to travel. And they felt that that part of the country was cut off. So I wasn't too surprised, especially with actually all the issues going on at Yorkshire and their financial struggle, that it was an easy decision, I think, for the ECB, given the strength of Durham's bid. And I think one of the things that they really liked was that Durham said all their women's games would also be at Chesterley Street, which isn't something that we normally see. And I know some of the other bids, it was sort of made known that some of the other bids had said, oh, the women can use these club grounds and out grounds, and that doesn't go down very well, when, as we all know, how women's county cricketers used to be treated 5 or 6 years or more ago.
And Polly, we mentioned, you know, non-100 hosting counties. What do you think this allocation means in particular to the likes of Durham, Somerset and Essex, who don't get that kind of attention and revenue through the 100?
It's a really big win for them. And I think particularly with Durham, the North East is just massively neglected. And that's not just cricket. That's entirely... I think also it's very significant for Durham because I believe they'll be the only professional women's sports team in Durham. In neighbouring Northumberland, they've got Newcastle Women, who turned professional in 2023 on the football side. But in terms of actually women's professional sport, it's quite sparse up there. So that's a massive win for them. I think it's quite interesting in Yorkshire's press release, because they seemed obviously very upset, but they kind of inferred that the franchise of Northern Diamonds belonged to them. And I found that quite interesting, because actually it belongs to Durham as much as it does to Yorkshire. So that was a little bit strange, but I can understand that they feel a little bit robbed. But as we understand, Durham's bid was very, very strong. In terms of Essex, I think it's really big as well, because that's a huge hub for women's sport. They've got FA Performance Centre there. They've got basketball and volleyball performance centres, I believe, as well. So just to strengthen sport there, and historically and even currently, women's cricket is very big there. They've got a very strong women and girls pathway. So that makes a lot of sense. And again, they don't have 100 franchise. So I think in some ways, I don't think they particularly said about being robbed of 100 franchise and things like that, as other counties may have done. But I think for them, that's really positive. And then Somerset, again, they were very clear that they wanted 100 franchise and they didn't get it. It went to Wales, it went to Glamorgan. And so to have women's cricket there and a professional side, I think is important. And then you see, we'll move on to it in a bit, I guess, but Glamorgan getting a team later on, the strength of women's cricket in the Southwest is only going to grow, because historically, and I've made the point, it's really not about history, but actually historically and currently, women's cricket is very well supported in the Southwest.
And there was just a few comments in terms of, speaking of counties, reactions from Sean Jarvis at Leicestershire, who kind of said that there might have been a missed chance to actually give a few more Tier 1 women's teams to non-100 owning counties. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's quite an interesting comment to make, because I get what he's trying to say, but realistically, county cricket is the bread and butter. The 100 is 4 weeks of the year. And it's a bidding process. You want the 8 best counties. You don't want the ones who were left to the side after the 100. You actually want the best product for women's cricket. And so I don't think the 100 should necessarily be a big part of those conversations. I think on the note of Leicestershire, they have every right to feel aggrieved. Of course, it did go to Nottingham, who, interestingly, they kind of control the Blaze franchise. And even though they have this whole idea, it's based at Trent Bridge, they've played one game there so far in their year's existence, which to me isn't a great look. I think also, this is just a personal opinion, but I think it's widely shared across cricket, that particularly women's cricket, it needs to develop in multi-ethnic urban centres and not kind of continue on the line of middle-class private school girls. And although they're still existing cricket, and that's great, actually Leicestershire would have been a great opportunity to develop that, because I know the county have done a lot of work in the community and have developed those pathways for women and girls from diverse backgrounds, and other counties can't offer that. So I do understand their comments, but at the same time, it shouldn't be kind of a default that if you don't have 100 team, you should automatically get a women's county.
And Nikki, broken finger bestie, I guess a question for you is that, you know, one of the stated goals of Project Darwin is to maximise on these existing county allegiances and fan bases to attract bigger crowds to the women's game. We've seen how much the international game has grown since 2017, the crowds coming in to watch the England women play, but not just that, we've seen great crowds at the Commonwealth Games when, you know, Sri Lanka were playing against Australia, and, you know, neutral games. And then the 100 has brought in great crowds for the women's game on that kind of domestic level. Do you think, you know, this is a good move in terms of achieving that objective of getting bigger crowds in?
I think overall it's a great move. And the only part of the decision that we mentioned earlier as you did the introduction, there's been three revolutions in 8 years. Part of me just thinks that shouldn't this have just been done initially? Maybe the whole professionalization of the women's sport could have come in a year later. But if it had come in the first place, because now obviously one of the factors that a lot of people are talking about, saying that fans, members are going to be able to feel more of this allegiance to the side if it's a Surrey women's team or if it's a Warwickshire women's team, as opposed to if it's a Central Sparks or a South East Stars, because it's a combination of counties and they don't really understand or can be fully committed. Surely that should have been something that's popped up around the table 8 years ago, as opposed to now suddenly thinking, actually, hang on, maybe that's going to be a factor that people are, we're not getting the crowds that we've predicted, or we could get more, should we do this? So overall for the women's game, I think it's great. It's been successful in the men's game. We see decent crowds in the men's format, in the domestic system. So yeah.
I guess it's similar to what Polly was saying, that over the years when we've had these eight regional hubs, it's been difficult to identify. Some teams seem to claim, you know, stakes in certain regions a bit more than others, and, you know, Lancashire might arguably say that Thunder is pretty much us because they're surrounded by a lot more of the national counties. So it's always been hard to kind of line up those allegiances. But I guess, you know, the overwhelmingly positive thing from all of this is that by 2029, the ECB have almost committed now to 12 professional women's tier one sides, which requires a big pool of players. It's going to require more funding to grassroots cricket and, you know, age group cricket to make sure there is enough good quality professionals around. You know, this can only be a good thing, right?
I think that's true. But I also think that what Nikki was saying about, you know, this should have come in earlier, and potentially it should, but what they were just looking for was a professional women's game. They couldn't do that with all the existing counties, and the women's county system makes even less sense than the men's does. Like, there's four different leagues. Some minor counties like Berkshire are historically very, very good and strong, and some of the, like, bigger counties have quite poor women's teams, I think it's fair to say, that are sort of somewhere near the bottom. So I think they couldn't really look to build on that. They had to start something different. Because it's sorting all of that out would have been incredibly complicated. And it's also would have not been very regionally well split, I think. Like, some of the stronger counties tend to be in the south and there aren't as many in the north. So I think doing regional hubs, which was much more geographical, was a good way to start, and now aligning it with the counties, they're basically doing it to make it more marketable, and to try and grow, like, the professionalization of it, but also make it a product that people want to come and watch, because that's what they want. They want it to be making money on its own. And I guess if you've just got a women's team with no bigger identity, that's harder to market.
I mean, you know, anyone looking from the outside will look at this and think it's a very convoluted process to go from one competition back to another, now back to counties, and it is a bit all over the place. But as you say, you know, clearly steps have been made in certain directions for reasons. Speaking of course, these eight tier one counties, initially, the ECB announced there's going to be two more in 2027. That's Yorkshire and Glamorgan. And then, as we said, two further teams in 2029. In the interim, Yorkshire and Glamorgan will receive new funding to help them prepare. The selection criteria for the 2029 teams is to be confirmed, but it would be interesting to know if this would look to uphold geographical balance and distribution, or if this would be reflective of T20 and 50 over tier two results. Might cause a bit of trouble if the same team wins both competitions. Then you've got to look at who came second place, but I'm sure that will be confirmed in time. The thing is, these changes reflect quite a significant change to the selection process and the structure presented in the invitation to tender. Now, the decision to extend Tier 1 to include Yorkshire and Glamorgan in 2027 was justified by the ECB, as the decision to select two additional counties, Glamorgan and Yorkshire, as the 9th and 10th Tier 1 clubs by 2027, and our stated aim to move to 12 teams in Tier 1 by 2029 is testament to the strength of the bids and the pace at which we want the move to effect change. Now, if a county is unhappy with this turn of events, well, tough luck, because Section 5.6 of the invitation to tender states that, well, there you go, I'm just going to put my lawyer hat on now. Are we ready? The ECB board is the only entity empowered to award Tier 1 women's team status, and its decision on such awards shall be final. The ECB board shall have no obligation to give any reasons for its decisions or to enter into any correspondence or other communications in relation to its decisions. The invitation to tender was presented, you know, as the culmination of 6 months' work and consultation with the counties. But when the invitation to tender was issued, you know, two key attachments were pretty much still in draft, and then fundamental changes have been made mid-bid. I mean, Polly, does this raise concerns that the process has been a little bit rushed, particularly, I guess, with the news coming out 2 days before the start of the professional domestic season?
Yeah, it does feel a little bit rushed, and I think it's not quite fair on the counties that the process wasn't clear. If there were still things in draft when they were making these bids, that's pretty poor, in my opinion. But I do also think that the ECB have to get it right. This is kind of their last shot. They've had so many attempts and it's gone wrong, it's gone right in certain ways. And I just think they kind of had to get it done. I also believe that the way women's sport is going and at the rapid pace that interest is growing, they had to make the change sooner rather than later. So I think this is the perfect year to do it. This is the best year to have the last year of the regional system and then change in October or whatever, the end of the season.
I was just going to say, just as you mentioned that, is anyone feeling a bit like sad that this is going to be the final season though with these teams we've come to know so well? I've seen like some farewell posts from people already and I'm like, I'm not sure I'm ready to let go of the Southern Vipers yet. Yeah, Polly's like, I think it's going
to be hard, especially for Vipers who have made an identity that is deliberately separate to Hampshire and all of that. And they have fans who aren't Hampshire fans. They're probably one of the biggest followings. And all of that's going to go when they become Hampshire Women or Hampshire Vipers or whatever name they end up on.
Is a Sussex fan going to support Hampshire?
Or why? What colours are they going to wear? Like, are they going to keep their orange or are they going to basically wear the men's team?
Well, I assume if you're going under the club board, you'll probably be wearing the club colours. Surely.
This could be awful because one of the best things about the women's game is the diversity of kits. But if they're, you know, adopting the men's club colours, how many navy kits are we going to suddenly get in the women's game? And that is something I fight really hard against. It's a struggle in the IPL at the moment. I mean, we're looking at the small things here. We're going to miss the bright orange to say. But Polly, you had a few more thoughts on this.
But yeah, I think also on the note of kits and things, I do really like the women's kits and the way they're so much more vibrant than men's kits and things like that. But I also think kind of the entire point of Project Darwin is to move to the same system as the men's and to create that one identity, that one club mentality, or so it's said. And I think if you are playing in different kits, and I know someone commented about perhaps the teams being known as like the Somerset Storm or things like that and taking part of the region, and actually I think that would be a massive mistake by the ECB because, I mean, that's the same as having the regions. Like, it's, you know, you need to be called Somerset Women or Hampshire Women and things like that because it's all about the identity at the end of the day. So I do think the kits will probably end up being the same with the men's, but yeah, there's going to be a lot less orange, I fear.
And Sonia, of course, you know, speaking of this change mid-bidding process, you know, announcing this planned expansion in 2027, 2029, do you think this would have changed things for potential bidders? For example, you mentioned certain counties experiencing financial difficulties at the moment. Could they have made a stronger case for maybe delayed accession in 27 or 29 based on the fact by then our finances will be in a better position? Just as an example, what do you think?
Well, I think Kent are going to be really annoyed because they have a full women's hub at Beckenham that houses the South East Stars. And I know they do train at the Oval, but their main hub is at Beckenham. and they're not one of the two teams. And it was never announced beforehand that there were going to be these two extra teams. Kind of feels slightly like they're appeasing 100 sides. And I don't think there's a way to look around that, because I do think that's slightly what they've done. They've just gone, oh, Glamorgan and Yorkshire, we don't want them to be too upset. They've got the 100 teams, so we'll sort of give them one. Without necessarily considering, well, maybe were they the best bid in 2 or 3 years' time? You know, it's, you're not looking suddenly at now. It might have been better to say, we're going to look to add two teams then. Can teams do a new bid based on having a team that goes in 2027?
I think it's tricky as well, of course, looking at, you know, they are the England and Wales cricket boards. They probably have some amount of pressure in making sure that there is a Welsh team involved in Tier 1 at some point. And you mentioned also the pressure coming from Yorkshire as well. I guess what kind of pressures will arise when, you know, you've got the promotion of two more counties in 2027, two more in 2029, will that impact any fan bases? And actually, as you say, is the criteria going forward for those next two teams to be raced going to be about geographical distribution, or is it going to just be looking at results? I think it's going to be interesting to find that one out. Nikki, is it optimistic for the ECB to, you know, pre-announce that there's going to be two extra teams in 2027, two more in 2029, without seeing the real life data and, you know, making sure that there is the fan base and there is the attraction in the crowds? And I guess those eight tier one teams are on their way to becoming self-sustainable, or do you think from them it's almost like a just great that they've committed to that without having to see that real life data?
Well, you and I had a brief discussion off air the other day when this was all announced, and I believe doesn't adding two teams in 2027 breach a core invitation to tender tenet in the first place of no team being able to go through for promotion? I think it's a bit far-fetched doing it so early, because those two teams are being promoted regardless of what their performances look like in 2025 and 2026. It could be pretty embarrassing if you don't perform well. And how do you justify your promotion compared to other counties who will outperform you? So I think to make that decision pretty early on, they could have held back on it. I just personally think it's unfair for the other counties who will also have to like compete against those two teams, Yorkshire and Glamorgan, because they'll also be benefiting from extra funding in the first place. So if you've got the extra funding and you can put in more resources and you can improve your whole production line of players in the pathway, then it's not really fair for counties, other counties they'll be competing against.
And also, if you're Durham and you sort of expect to get a lot of Northern Diamonds players, suddenly a lot of them might say, well, I'll wait 2 years and I won't have to move house or anything. And I'll just, Yorkshire are going to get there in 2 years' time, so why would I make the move up to Durham? And it does dent Durham and Somerset's sort of chances of getting those top players.
Just a question, like, do you think there was, like, Elise, Sonia, Mel, do you think there was a chance that there could have actually had 10 counties, like tier ones announced this year? Because if you look at how many girls are playing up and down the country, would it have been feasible? Was there a chance that it could have been 10?
I don't imagine there was enough money, to be honest, because they are penny pinching and the ECB doesn't know how much money it's going to have. So I don't think it could launch into fully funding all those contracts, all those extra contracts at once.
Yeah, I agree, because at the moment, I think Lancashire Thunder are the only county that have 15 full-time professionals. I know, for example, Sparks have like summer full-time contracts, but obviously that doesn't go through the winter. So you add 30 more contracts, that's a lot more money. And I think, of course, the quality of the Rachel Hayer Flint and Charlotte Edwards Cup is amazing at the moment, but add two more sides in, a lot of those players won't have been full-time before. So they're suddenly going from being amateur players to full-time. And that's kind of similar teething problems we saw at the start of the regional system, where players were going from having like a job and playing part-time cricket to full-time. And that kind of worked because everyone was in the same boat. But the more that kind of gap widens, the harder it is to integrate those players once you've got domestic players that have been pros for 4 or 5 years.
I guess as well, we've seen from this weekend with Tammy Beaumont getting married today, Saturday, as we're recording. Many congratulations to Tammy about that. But, you know, you also can't guarantee that your England players are going to be around. And even those involved in England Academy, you know, there's so much concern about resting players and making sure they're not overworked at the moment as well. I think if a few got pulled out whilst the international team have groups on, there might be a few shortages. But we mentioned just there Durham and the almost potential to get a bit isolated if players just return back to Yorkshire after 2 years. Do they almost look particularly vulnerable because, you know, they're so far in the northeast? If Yorkshire almost get on their southern border, does it block out their access to southern players? Will they have to really, you know, think up some incentives and some great, you know, ways to attract players? Could they invite a bit more, you know, I guess participation from maybe Scotland? I don't know. I'm thinking wild here because I love Durham and I want to care for them.
Yeah, I mean, Northern Diamonds at the moment have quite a few Scottish players, and so I'd imagine that is quite a big incentive because actually Scottish cricket is growing and they have got a couple of pro contracts, but they're not really full-time contracts. So if Scottish players are wanting to play full-time cricket, actually going to Durham is a really good option, and they're less likely to leave and go to Yorkshire, for example, or leave and go down south. And yes, Durham is far away if you live on the south coast or whatever. But actually, I think it's a real opportunity for Durham. And I think they'll be watching out for Yorkshire because they know that's coming. And they know that they've kind of got 2 years to do really well and want players to stay there and create an environment that players don't want to go back to Yorkshire if they've moved from Leeds or whatever. But it's a really challenging one, and I imagine it will kind of be, well, similar-ish for Somerset if Glamorgan and potentially Gloucestershire get in there. I know it's a slightly bigger area, but it does pose a bit of a problem because although there are quite a few pro players at the moment, the actual pool of women's cricketers isn't huge. And a lot of that will be relying on younger players coming through the system. And I reckon younger players won't massively want to relocate. So I don't know. It depends. But it will be an interesting one to see because I guess it's a dilemma that hasn't quite come up yet in women's cricket before.
I guess from this, an interesting precedent's been set because in allowing contingent counties in Yorkshire and Durham to be tier one counties, those two additional clubs who will be promoted in 2029... you know, they'll come from the remaining tier two sides, but they've now shown that neighbouring counties can both be tier one. I mean, you mentioned Gloucestershire there. I mean, obviously I'm involved in Gloucestershire and there was disappointment to not achieve that tier one status because it's a great setup down there. But, you know, if I was looking at them, I'd just be going, accelerate those plans for your new stadium as soon as possible, you know, to try and draw in that attraction on the M4, M5 interchange, a multi-sport purpose venue. But then you're also going, goodness, the funds and finances aren't in a good place. It's a really kind of tricky position, particularly for them now going, we're going to have Glamorgan on one side, Somerset below us. Is there any chance of us being promoted to tier one? But do you think, I guess, because of that neighbouring relationship between Durham and Yorkshire, counties like potentially Kent or Sussex might just be licking their lips and going, there's still a chance here for us to get promoted in 2029 because it doesn't matter if we're neighbours with another tier one county.
Yeah, 100%. And I think you look at those counties and they're actually very strong for women's cricket and they are quite unlucky to miss out. I think the big kind of point for them will be facilities based. They need more outgrounds. I think even some of the counties that have been picked for tier one, you look and actually they're relying on school grounds or not very well. But I think about Warwickshire, and you've got Edgbaston Foundation Ground and it's all right, but I don't think it's not properly equipped to have a proper commentary setup and things like that. And there's not enough space for players. And so all the counties will have to look at that. But yeah, you look at Yorkshire and Durham and other counties will see that as an opportunity, think, oh, we can do that too. I think it will be we don't really know what's going to happen at the moment, but in terms of academies and that pathway, how that's going to work, because I'm not sure how it will work with, say, for example, you've got Hampshire who are tier one side, and then you've got Sussex who are tier two. Do the Sussex youth players merge into the Hampshire system? How will that all work? And then if Sussex suddenly become tier one, then are the players going to return? And I mean, I know we've touched on that before, but I think the academy side is slightly left in the dark at the moment?
So what I've briefly heard is potentially it's just going to be like a rebrand of the name for the academy side. So if it's a Southeast Stars Academy, that will just become a Surrey Academy, and they're still trying to figure things out. So not everything's set in stone yet, which is the other part of this entire announcement that I feel they should have got everything together and given everyone a full out package of this is what's happening, it's clear. Otherwise there's so much speculation going on and we're having this discussion here, what's going to happen and where are these girls going to go, and imagine the players themselves as well, like imagine how much uncertainty they're thinking and where am I going to go next year, what's happening, who am I playing for. It's a lot to deal with.
Well, let's go into this more, because of course the original allocation of the tier one counties was prematurely leaked in the Telegraph by Will McPherson, who is fantastic at getting the information out at that little bit sooner. But I know all of you guys have spoken to some professional players, some amateur county players. Let's start with the professionals. Sonia, I know in your article in The Independent, you spoke to Bryony Smith and Freya Davis. What were their thoughts on the news?
Well, I spoke to them before it had been announced, but I spoke to Freya about obviously joining the Vipers, and you're joining a side that may not exist in a year, and what happens to that. And that's quite, I think, convoluting for players, especially if, in terms of, one thing that does worry me about the academy system is if you're a really good youth player and you live in Kent, are you suddenly going to have to travel to Surrey for all of your training? And how much pressure does that put on people from disadvantaged backgrounds with that extra travel? And also, is there going to be funding for it? Because a lot of people don't have parents willing to drive them 2 hours to training and matches.
It's certainly, you know, a big part of this, because some of these changes are being brought in to implement the goals of the ICEC report and, you know, work towards those goals of equal pay and opportunity for female professional cricketers. But as you say, you've also got to keep that one eye on, actually, are all these changes going to cause people quite a lot of financial difficulties? And this is just, as you say, for people involved in the academies and involved in the teams. Nikki, I want to kind of speak about, I guess, the balance of the emotional toll of a news like this 2 days before the start of the season for some players. I know players have recently brought homes and, you know, flats nearby to their regional centres. And, you know, to have this news 2 days before the start of the season probably hasn't been the best thing. But then also, how do we balance these considerations with actually, you know, the recognition that these are professional athletes, and for those years they are playing cricket, this might just be a reality of being a professional athlete, that you will have to move, you might not have a settled base. How do we kind of balance that, I guess, human level and then that expectation as an athlete?
The way the announcement was done was actually quite, like, it did make me laugh, because it reminded me of when the England men's contracts were announced just before the World Cup, and obviously how that would have shaken up certain individuals. And yeah, definitely it's going to have a huge impact, especially girls who've just brought houses and just committed, relocated. You literally switch, you change your entire life, don't you? And now again, if they've been prepared that they've got a contract and they're going to be based in Warwickshire or based down in Beckenham for the next 2 years, and now I'm gonna think, wait, do I have to move again? I've just got a house, I've got more. It's not easy, right? And everyone's young and they're navigating this whole big world of adulting and figuring things out, and then you're a professional cricketer as well, you've got pressures of performing and making sure your contract gets renewed, and there's a lot to keep up on it. But then again, it happens in the corporate world as well, right? You could be made redundant and you've just bought a house and you've got to figure things out. So I think the adaptability is important, but overall I just think, because there's been so much chop and change over the last 8 years, just the uncertainty that as a player you still can't be able to be comfortable, like, you, like, at night you'll have to sleep with like your eye like kind of open, because you still don't know what's going to happen. Something could change again 2 years down the track, and then what? And you're literally just being played around like you're some, what do you play chess with?
A pawn.
You're literally just being played around like a pawn on a chessboard. And you're being moved.
The conclusion come to.
And that county becomes a region. Where do you go? I think that's the part that I also don't quite quite understand.
Well, let's get into this. First of all, Nikki, I love that your conclusion was that everyone's being really brave, guys. Life's scary, but great job, everyone, whether you're a corporate girly or whether you're an athlete girly. Great job. But Sonia, you raise a really good point because, you know, lots of people have raised the issue of what happens to a, you know, a tier one current amateur player. For example, what happens to the current Essex Women's County players? Do they have to play for Middlesex or Kent or Suffolk? Do they play club cricket? Or ultimately, for some people in their lives, in their careers, do they just give up? I mean, we have a current Surrey cricketer on the call with us. So, Nikki, I'm going to start with you because, you know, as a current amateur player at a tier one county, what's the initial reaction been? Has there been any communication from within the county? And, you know, what are the initial concerns you have apart from drafting your cricketing CV?
In terms of the reactions, I'd say it's been mixed, 100%. I've spoken to quite a few of the girls over the last few days and to take into account how everyone's feeling. Obviously, if you're representing Surrey, but you're also part of a region and you're representing the South East Stars and then you play for Surrey Women as well, everyone's fine. Everyone's loving it because they're not being affected. It's going to be the girls that only have Surrey Women to represent. And unfortunately, just doing some digging, it's going to be a certain age group of girls that are going to be hit even more. Because if you're a part of the academy or an ABP program, you're going to be under 18 more often than not. Pretty sure there's an age cap as well. So you're just going to get rebranded. But if you're not part of an academy EPP program and you're only playing for Surrey or playing for Essex at the moment, and you still want to continue playing, you have to look elsewhere. And I think that's potentially what's going to have to happen, that if you're representing Surrey Women, we're going to have to go and look at playing for a tier two or a tier three county, Kent, going to Berkshire, whichever, which I think is quite a hard pill to swallow for quite a lot of people, because I've spoken to quite a few players, and especially if you've been at a club for your entire life. Imagine playing age group cricket from under 11s through to senior women's cricket. You've spent 15 years, 16 years dedicated to a club or just dedicated to county cricket and being in the pathway. And overnight, or not really overnight, but we've known it for a few months, this is going to happen. But overnight, when the news was announced, that's all changed. And in a really simple way, I feel like a lot of people will be serving their notice period right now, because where do you go after this?
I mean, as you say, it feels like it's going to disproportionately impact players who are out of age group county cricket, you know, as you say, 18, 21 plus, particularly those who work full time as well. Sonia, I mean, again, bringing up the reflections of the ICEC and the impact on current professional and kind of players, what do you, I mean, these players who currently play county cricket are amateurs who most likely have jobs to get by. They play at the weekends. They maybe train once a week across the winter. I know in my position, we get some of our playing kit sorted. Our training's now being covered, although Gloucestershire's with the Gloucestershire Cricket Foundation, not actually the county club. But I mean, do you think this is making cricket more inaccessible? And as a second part to that, do you think that women's club cricket right now is in a strong enough position to maybe take in a bit of an influx of players who are potentially kind of giving up or might give up on the county game? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think a lot of people will give up on the county game. I think if you're living in sort of Guildford and you don't want to travel down to Brighton to play, or Hove to play for Sussex, you aren't really left with that many options. I mean, you could go to Berkshire, but they might end up being a tier three side, and whether you want to take that sort of risk of playing a lower level. And it's a lot of travel, because I'm imagining tier two will also be national. So they're going to be semi-professional and still asked to potentially travel up and down the country, which I would argue is quite unreasonable. Even if your sort of expenses are being covered, it's a lot to ask people to give up, you know, basically all their social life, do a job at the same time, and travel.
Particularly as women's games played on Sundays as well, and already looking ahead this season, I know I'm going to have some games where I'm getting back quite late and then having to be in the office the next day. I know this is a struggle people have been comprehending for decades now, but as a recently admitted corporate girly, you realise how utterly exhausting it is to play on Sundays when, you know, men are primarily using the grounds and the pitches on Saturdays. It is a big effort, and I saw lots of people, particularly in club cricket, dropping out when they reached their mid-20s, because the you know, the costs of it, which weren't getting reimbursed on a club level, and just the exhaustion of it was becoming too much. Nikki, you have some more to add on that?
Yeah, no, I was just going to go back to say, so obviously having spoken to some of the girls just up and down the country who've been affected by this, will they continue playing? Well, a lot of people probably won't. The idea was that, oh, if this current level of what county cricket is gets dismissed, those girls will start going back to women's club cricket, which, let's be honest, a lot of people contemplate why they're stood on the field for 50 overs on a Sunday afternoon with the standard of what it is. So will they want to go and then pay £10 match fee to go and do that, when if you've been part of the system for such a long time, you're used to playing competitive cricket. You want to play at a certain standard. And if that's the case, a lot of people will be opting to play men's cricket on a Saturday. So will it do more harm than good in terms of boosting women's club cricket? It's a question that we'll find out later. But it is concerning, because it's sad to see how it's going to affect a lot of players who've given their life to it. And I understand it's, like you've mentioned, will it be enough? Will people still want to be playing? But I think there's a part, if you've been in the game for so long, you're playing because you enjoy it, and you've got a group of girls around you that you've grown up playing with, and you'll enjoy competitive sport, and just to be like that, to be snatched away from you, is quite like demoralizing. And I think Polly mentioned earlier that they'd probably be looking at relying on younger players, obviously, to feed the system later down the years. But why are we going to be just relying on younger players? The BCCI announced yesterday or 2 days ago their squad to go play against Bangladesh women. And Shabana Asha, who played for RCB in the WPL, has been called up, and she's 34 years of age. So if people are able to make their debut at 34, why, in India, and a country that's absolutely thriving in the women's game, why are people going to be deterred just because they're slightly elder, and say, let's focus on the younger ones? We've spoken to Thea Brooks on the podcast before, who's been told that pretty like bluntly. So I think that's going to happen a lot, and it's really sad.
I think that's part of the problem with how women's cricket is in this country, is when they went regional and started introducing those professional contracts, a lot of older players who were performing really well at their counties weren't picked up, because they were basically like, no, we don't want anyone over the age of 25. We're looking for future England players. And they didn't make the cut. And I just worry if the same thing is essentially going to happen again.
And I think cricket is such a sport that it's like wine, right? You pick up so much maturity with age. You get better with age. Obviously, there's certain aspects of the game that you constantly need to work on that won't be on your side. But the maturity that you get with being on the pitch for longer, being in different situations for longer, across different formats, you can't just buy that and expect a young person to come in with all of that. It will take time. And I think there has to be some credibility given to those sorts of players in slightly elder age brackets. And still, I don't think that's old. That's the thing. If you're mid-20s, 30, it's not old. Since when have we suddenly thought that we need to bin these players?
Nikki, I'm considered an experienced campaigner now, which is a nickname for one foot in the cricketing grave, which is concerning. Polly, you've got some more thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think I kind of echo what Sonia was saying about there's kind of like an obsession with youth. And I get that. I get you want to build for the future. But it, even as someone who's never ever played county cricket, not got anywhere near it, it makes me quite angry that there's such a neglected age group, and there's such an issue in across the world with girls dropping out of sport. And if you essentially, in your professional system, you basically say, if you haven't done well by the time you turn 18, then that's it. And that is incredibly frustrating, because why is there's no incentive to play them? People won't want to play county cricket. And the county system has been so incredibly neglected, especially since the region has come in. It's got worse, I think, since the regions have come in. And so to say, OK, we're doing this big upheaval, a big change in women's cricket, domestic cricket's going to be fantastic. Well, you're forgetting a lot of your players. You're forgetting everyone who's doing it unpaid. And it feels like a massive missed opportunity, because yes, it's amazing that all this professionalism is happening, and that's wonderful. But once again, it's that age group that are neglected. And cricket's been taken away from them. You have to play men's cricket, which, I mean, some people will really love that. But if you've played county cricket, as we've mentioned, since you were like 11 years old, that's been your entire life, really. And to completely strip someone of that, and not through really fault of their own, that I don't think feels fair at all.
And if, like, we're going to be talking about the recommendations from the ICEC report, where we said we need equal opportunity, more opportunities given as well, you're only giving opportunities to the people you've already selected and you like. That's not, are you really actually opening up that pool of opportunities to everyone?
I mean, we've questioned before on the podcast about, you know, previously, as Polly says, the county game was really neglected within the regional structure. Whether there was any opportunity to jump that huge chasm between county and regional cricket, was there scouts going around? Would there be an opportunity for a 24, 25 year old who had a great county season to suddenly get picked up in the academy? I'm not so sure, and I'm not so sure there was the framework in place to also pick up on late developers as well. Now, there's been a couple of rumours that, you know, tier one counties might be allowed to run amateur 11s, or they might have second 11s. But I guess, Polly, I wanted to ask you if you think, you know, have you heard anything of that likes? And if counties, if tier one counties were allowed second 11s, would they just be more kind of like, you know, professional second 11s or the academies now? Would it actually cater for the amateur players, or are they pretty much going to have to find another county or stop playing?
Honestly, I think it would act as an academy. If I mean, you see the way the regions have second 11s at the moment, it tends to be that's when they trial young players in matches. And I know they have academy festivals and stuff at the moment, which is amazing, but actually a lot of those players will play in those second 11s. Occasionally, I know, for example, with Central Sparks, they've used it for fringe players. But again, that's not always the case. And I also do understand from their perspective how if you do have amateur 11s alongside, that slightly defeats the point of tier two and tier three. And I understand that kind of conflict of interest. But at the same time, it's the point of these people have played for this county for their whole life. Are you just going to kick them out because you've got this new system? That, again, doesn't feel fair. But I think it will be used as an opportunity to integrate younger players into that squad, use it as players that are coming back from injury and things like that. So I don't think if they do have amateur 11s, it will actually be used effectively.
Now, just to round up this chat on Project Darwin, a question for all three of you. Obviously, the ECB are pledging 1.3 million annually into the eight teams, but the counties are expected to generate funds themselves, and there is the general hope of all of this becoming self-sustainable. The counties were responsible for the women's game for quite a long period of time, and there was quite a severe amount of neglect. Can we trust the counties to deliver on these promises they made during the bids? You know, have times changed enough now that we can, I guess, trust them to deliver on these promises?
I think we have to, just because that's what is being asked of them. I think they've waited long enough that counties actually want a women's side. Whereas I know when I was playing junior county cricket, they definitely didn't want us at all. We were kicked out of training at the hub and had to go to a school about an hour and a half away from where I lived. And that was at sort of under 15, under 17 level. So I hope that it's got significantly better than that. Although it's worth saying that that county did not get a tier one women's team. But I think you have to. I don't think there's another way forward for it. But I do think that there's a lot of people probably at my age, sort of late 20s, who are looking at it and going, hang on, they always gave us men's kit. They never gave us any training. They dropped you if you couldn't make training, even though it was inaccessible on public transport. Like, do we really trust them to have our best interests at heart? And I do think that a lot of people in the women's game haven't forgotten how they were treated sort of 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I hope they'll be held accountable to some extent. I don't know how much the ECB will be involved in that, but I'll hold them accountable. I'll pull them up if they're not doing what they're saying, because it is really frustrating. We've already seen with Lancashire Thunder, we can kind of trust them because Lancashire have kind of taken over that region and they've done that for the last few years. I mean, they have a floodlight of one of their former players. Like, talk about commitment. They've got a dressing room dedicated to the women's side. So when men's teams come, they're not using the away dressing room. It's very, the women are very much integrated there. And that's, I think, the perfect example of how to talk the talk, walk the walk. They're actually walking the walk, and they're doing what they're saying, and they're actually committing to it, which for some counties, I just don't think they'll do it. And that's kind of the reality of women's cricket, and that's a real shame. But I like to think that, you know, I know there might be financial barriers, but I like to think that the counties will do their best to deliver on their promises, because at the end of the day, I think people, particularly the other counties, will be looking at them and saying, oh, well, you're not doing that, because they feel aggrieved that they've missed out. And so if they can find a problem with any other county, I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't want to point that out.
And Nikki?
And I was going to say, obviously, Polly, you just mentioned that how well Lancashire have done to promote and give the women's side that equal opportunity and equal platform. And I think they've made such great headway that, in a way, I think counties will have to live up to that, because otherwise it's not going to look good on them either. And honestly, like, when you look on social media and you see it's not just their men's side being promoted, it's a lot of content coming out from the women's. Like, A, it feels really nice to see, because just being part of the system and we're in this industry, it's nice that we can see the work that's actually being executed. But I think for a lot of other counties, it will be important that they'd have to match up to it. Otherwise, it's not going to look so great on them. And hopefully that means that we will see better planning and procedures ahead compared to what we've seen previously. But then again, it's only a matter of just waiting and see what happens.
So let's finish off by chatting about maybe some lighter topics, because as we speak, the first round of the Rachel Hayhoe Flint 50 over trophy is happening. And Polly has prepared, I shall add, a brilliant souvenir album for the women's domestic season, which I recommend everyone reads. It is going to be right next to me every time I'm covering. Every time I'm covering the women's game this season. But I just want to hear what everyone's predictions are for the upcoming season. I've asked everyone to do a bit of homework, and they're going to go through and explain who they think are going to be winners in both the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy and the Charlotte Edwards Cup, and who they think their either best or breakout or one to watch in terms of batter, bowler and keeper. So Sonia, we're going to start with you. What are your guesses?
Oh, thanks for doing that, so I can't just jump on what anyone else says. Winners of the Rachel Hayhoe Flint, I've gone for the Vipers. Not just because they won it last year, but partly just because of how dominant they've been in that format over the last few years. Well, since we had the previous one and they weren't called that, they were called something different. But anyway, for the Charlotte Edwards Cup, I think the South East Stars. I think they're just such an explosive T20 side. For a batter, I've gone for Holly Armitage. For bowler, I said Georgia Adams is one to watch. And as a keeper, I went for Rihanna Sothby.
I absolutely love this for Georgia Adams, that from having so many brilliant seasons with the bat, all it took was Charlotte Edwards to put her name down on the bowling card for her now to be our predicted bowler of the year. I absolutely love that for her. Good predictions. Right, Polly, who have you got?
So I've gone a little bit unconventional. I've gone Rachel Hayhoe Flint winners are going to be the Sunrisers. They've had a rough couple of years, but they won 4 on the bounce at the end of last season. They've got captain Grace Gribbons, who is absolutely fantastic. I mean, they've started their campaign well, bowling Western Storm out for 114. So I reckon they could go on and do it. Charlotte Edwards Cup, I'm going to say Thunder. I know a little bit rogue, but they need silverware. They've got everything in place to get silverware. They've got some really good players. They're way stronger in the T20s. They're not great in the 50 over, but T20s, I think, is their format. They've got a new head coach, Chris Reid. They did really well on the pre-season tour. They've got Australian Katie Mack, who's won quite a lot. She's won the WBBL a couple of times. So I don't see why they can't win that. In terms of batter, I'm sticking with the Thunder theme. I'm going Saren Smail. She's done really well for England A. She got 100 in a warm-up against Central Sparks. She's a very chirpy wicketkeeper, although I don't think she'll be behind the stumps much. But she's very entertaining to watch. Bowler, I've gone Katie Levick. She seems to just get better with age. And I think professionalism has really helped her, and she's come a long way. And she was in the top 5 wicket takers for both competitions last year, I think. And we always love a leg spinner. And then wicket keeper, I've stuck with the Thunder theme, and I've gone for Ellie Threlkeld. I would argue she's probably the best wicket keeper in the regional system. Her leg side stumpings are so impressive. I mean, they go viral quite a lot, but they're brilliant. And I think she'll do really well this season.
Right, Nikki, have you had time to think of your predictions?
Literally just about, but I'm going to keep it really quick because we are short on time. So we're going to go with the Charlotte Edwards Cup. I'm going to go Thunder, because I just really like them as a unit. And I think they've got really good individual players. And I'd hope together, like it, they can be really powerful. So I'm gonna go with Thunder. Rachel Hayhoe-Flynn, I'm gonna go with Vipers. Okay, for my keeper, it's really straightforward for me. I'm gonna go with Rhys Southby. I think she's brilliant behind the gloves, and especially being picked up with the England A team over the winter. Great one to watch. And bowler wise, I want to echo Sonia and say Georgia Adams, but also I really want to see more of Mahika Gore this year, because obviously she's got stronger and she's grown older, so she's got more pace on her. That will be pretty exciting to see, especially in the women's game. Like, I'd like to see some more like quick bowlers. And with batting, I'll go with Saran Smal as well, because I really like the way she bats, and I've seen some good footage, and I think she's especially like one for the longer innings.
Right, I don't know why I've put myself last, because I feel like I've got a point to prove by choosing something different to everyone else. But for Rachel Hayhoe-Flynn Trophy, I'm going to go for Blaze. You know, they're a newly formed team. They almost got there before. I think it might just depend on the availability of some England players, but you know, they're a team full of talent, and even without their England players, I think they could still pull it home because they've got that kind of temperament. For that Charlotte Edwards Cup, I'm going to go for the South East Stars, because I love the South East Stars. They're just one of the funniest teams to follow, because even in the 50-over stuff, they either hit 350 or they get bowled out for 80, and that's the kind of cricket I love to watch. But I think if all their performances kind of get stuck together, I think they'll be able to pull through and lift that trophy. And as we say, there's a lot of pressure on this season to get some silverware before these teams disband. So I'm sure they'll be eyeing that up. In terms of batter, I'm also going Holly Armitage, because I was gutted her England debut kind of came as a result of a concussion and she had to bat down the order. Also a bit doubtful of whether that was quite an accurate concussion swap, but either way, it wasn't too costly. And New Zealand still went on to win that one. But I think she's a great player, and I think she's also proof of what we were saying, that with more experience, players should still have that chance a bit later on in their careers. In terms of bowler, I'm going for Casti McCarthy of the Blaze, because I was involved in her down at the Vipers Academy years and years ago, and she just moved the ball so nicely. And I've been seeing some pre-season clips, and she's got that ball absolutely hooping. I think there's three dismissals just kissing the top of off stump. So I'm hoping for more of that. And in terms of keepers, I am going for Abby Freeborn, because I think, you know, she brings a lot to the team in terms of her batting as well, because she made a brilliant pre-season 100. But I just think she's got a bit of tenacity and bite about her, and I like that determinism. But there we go, guys. We've done it. We've spoken about Project Darwin. We've spoken about the season. Goodness, if this is how it's going to start, we are in for a very long one. But I absolutely can't wait. And thank you so much to Sonia Twigg and to Polly Starkey for coming on this episode. This episode is also going to be available on Polly's podcast feed for the Naughty Child podcast. So go give them a follow and a listen if you don't already. I'm sure you do. But for now, thanks so much, guys, for joining us today. And for everyone listening, do get in touch at Storylines Pod on Twitter or Instagram. But bye for now.
Bye.